Dear Sugar is supported by
The universe has good news for the lost, lonely, and heartsick. Sugar is here, the both of us, speaking straight into your ears. I'm Cheryl Strayed.
I'm Steve Almond. This is Dear Sugar Radio.
Oh, dear soul, won't you please share some bittersweet days with me? Every day, oh, in the sugar you send my way.
Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Steve. Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah and all of that stuff.
And Kwanzaa now. Come on.
Kwanzaa.
Mm-hmm.
The solstice, which I would like to note, given the conversation we're about to have.
Yes.
Solstice. Longest night of the year, darkest day.
Mm-hmm.
So we think of holiday time as like light and cheer. There's a dark side to the holidays.
Yes.
We're going to have some fun today and talk about the light sides and then some of the hard things. And some of the things we're going to talk about today are a little comic in nature and other things, some of the deepest stuff we've ever talked about.
Not so comic. Well, this is the thing about holidays is that there is this super high-speed collision of like enforced merriment and gathering together with all the people you love the most in the world, and it should be this wonderful, ecstatic experience where you're full of gratitude and goodwill for man. And people's actual experiences of the holidays are not all the time, but oftentimes filled with just the opposite: stress, anxiety, dread even. These letters that we're going to talk about are raising the very common but little discussed experience that the holidays are a trial for many people.
So let's begin. Dear Sugar, let me start by saying I love my in-laws. I have known them since I was 16. My husband and I were high school sweethearts. My situation is unique because both sets of our parents live within 20 minutes of each other. You would think this makes life easier when we go home to visit for the holidays. But in fact, it has made visits extremely challenging. Before we realized this was going to be a problem, my husband and I never talked about splitting up the time between our two families. We figured it would happen organically. But what ends up happening is my husband's family jumps at the opportunity to spend as much time with us as possible, and my family ends up getting cheated out of time. One trip home, my husband and I slept separately for a week. I was at my house, he was at his, because I hadn't seen my family. But he felt an intense obligation to spend evenings with his parents. Although my mother-in-law is in the driver's seat when it comes to a lot of these issues, my father-in-law doesn't stop her, and he has an especially bad habit of making my husband feel incredibly guilty for not eating dinner with them every night when we're at home. I thought we found a good solution by giving both sets of in-laws a schedule of when and where we will be staying, but when we're at my house, my husband's mother will start calling his cell phone around 7 a.m., and every half hour until he answers the phone. Or if he doesn't, she will then call my parents' home number or my cell phone and ask for my husband to call her when he wakes up so they can talk about our plans for the day when we are not scheduled to see them that day. This was annoying when we were in college, but now it's verging on crazy. My husband did speak with his mother, but she began crying, and she didn't understand why her behavior made us feel disrespected and like children. When we told them we were joining the Peace Corps, for example, it took almost 2 years before we left to change the reaction from, "No, please don't go," to, "You'll have an amazing experience." I'm especially worried because now we are in the Peace Corps, and when we go home for Christmas, it will be our first trip home in almost a year and a half. His mother called dibs on picking us up from the airport. I couldn't help but laugh at this request. We hadn't even bought our flights home yet. I welcome any advice you have for me on this. My husband is reluctant to address these issues head on. He feels that since we don't see them often, why bring up the negative when we do see them? I understand this, but I also know that if we continue to ignore it, it will only get worse, especially after we return to live in the U.S. Thank you, frustrated daughter-in-law.
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah, a yeeks. Look, frustrated daughter-in-law, yeah, you're right. If you ignore it, it's going to get worse, and it's already pretty silly.
Yeah.
You know? It's lovely that you both have loving families. That's a beautiful, wonderful blessing. And it's great that they want to spend a lot of time with you. But the guilt tripping and the calling at 7 in the morning and the not obeying the clear boundaries that you're trying to set, that is actually childish behavior. And you're right to not want to consent to it. And you're right to say to your husband, this is not okay. I think probably the husband feels guilty because he's very loyal to his family and he has decided for reasons that are good and important to live far away from them. This is what the holidays can become. They invoke this sort of who is important, and that's signified by how much time the honored out-of-town relatives get with particular families.
Yeah, it seems like a very clear-cut situation to me that this couple, frustrated daughter-in-law and her husband, need to establish those boundaries with his parents. Obviously, they're doing this because they madly love their son and they want every minute of his time when he's in town. But the fact of the matter is he's married now. And this is about the husband growing up and setting that boundary with his parents. I think that one of the reasons that daughter-in-law signs her name frustrated daughter-in-law is because she's really a frustrated wife.
Correct.
Okay. So she's not able to really get her husband on board with this idea that they have built a family anew with each other. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean at all shutting out their families of origin. I mean, this actually sounds like a very loving young woman who wants to have meaningful relationships with his parents. So, you know, before we get any in-laws involved in any conversations about who's going to visit who, I would counsel the two of them, this couple, to really talk about it. I mean, he can't go to his parents and say, listen, we really are going to spend half the time with my wife's parents and half the time with you. Yeah. He can't say that with clarity unless he feels that kind of clarity and certainty in his own heart.
I agree she should talk to her husband, but my point is that if he is not going to bring himself to this just unilaterally, she shouldn't just put him in the position of being the go-between, because then he's in this terrible situation where his loyalties are divided and he, in the back of his mind, is thinking, I want to deliver this message, but I don't want to deliver it in a way that's going to hurt my parents' feelings. And clearly, that message has not been delivered. I feel that he should go with her. And the reason I feel that is because otherwise they're going to say, oh, I get it. It's that daughter-in-law of ours. He needs to, in her presence with her, say, hey, we're united on this. This is always the battleground that, you know, this is why that in-law relationship is so fraught. We've talked about it because the primacy of this mom is being replaced by his wife. And she's not trying to push this family away, but they're smothering. And believe me, it's going to get worse, because when kids are in the picture, then there's a whole additional potential battleground if you don't make it clear. Right.
Right. Well, she says that he's reluctant to address these issues head on.
Right.
But let me tell you what I think will happen if he doesn't. That is, his wife is going to go from feeling like she loves her in-laws and wants to honor them and spend time with them
to being resentful.
To resenting them and feeling bitter and angry and cheated.
Right. And she sort of does a little bit already.
She does a little bit already, but it's early enough in this process. I mean, that she can turn things around. They can turn things around. And so if the husband here is listening, I hope he is, because I will say to him, you know, this conflict that you're hoping to avoid, this is not going to go away.
Right.
Okay. 10 years from now, whether you have kids or not, this is going to be a much uglier situation if the two of you don't decide to move forward as a united front. I agree with you that they should both be there in that conversation. I think the husband should take the lead because he's their son. He's the one they love unconditionally. I think it wouldn't serve them to have this conversation framed as if, you know, the daughter-in-law is pushing for this. I think that it's always really important for the child who is the son or daughter of the in-laws in question that, you know, really takes the lead on that.
Right.
But I think you're absolutely right. Sitting there together as a unified front is really important. There is a piece of this that it's so hard to have conflict. It's so hard to sit in a room and say something confrontational to somebody, to say something that will disappoint somebody you love. Mm-hmm. And this husband says, well, why bring up the negative? We're talking about, 10 days over, you know, the course of December. Well, really, the answer to that is because it's important. It's important that you establish yourselves as a family. There's a reason that frustrated daughter-in-law wrote to us. It's essentially this little seed
right.
that's going to grow bigger and
yeah.
bigger and bigger.
And it's an unhealthy dynamic in which
yeah.
she has the clarity to recognize this is a kind of love that's possessive in its nature. Pretty soon, if it continues to go on, it is going to become an issue in your marriage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or it already is to a small extent. She's clearly not angry at her husband. She's sympathetic to how loyal he is. But you can't be loyal in a way that ultimately is avoiding being forthright and getting pushed around.
And
that's
not
a little
being,
bit what's happened.
It's not being disloyal. It's not being disloyal to
right.
say, hey, you both live in the same town. It's only fair that we're half the time here and half the time there. Let's just get that right out there. And one piece of advice I would give to this couple when they're preparing for this conversation
mm-hmm.
is to write a script. That sounds ridiculous and sort of overdetermined, but whenever I've had to say something hard to somebody,
mm-hmm.
I've had to say some hard things to family members like we all have, and what I found is I'll get nervous in the moment or overly emotional in the moment
yeah.
or defensive. And even though I don't walk in the room with the script and read from the script, what I find is really helpful is beforehand, write down everything I have to say. And I would recommend that they first acknowledge how much they love these parents. And then they lay out in very clear, concrete, concise terms what their dilemma is and how they have decided to solve it.
Yeah.
And I think that when you go in prepared, knowing what you're going to say, you're less likely to respond to some of the heightened emotion or drama of the moment.
Which these parents are likely to produce.
Right.
I would very strongly advise for you, frustrated daughter-in-law, and in general, have this discussion before the holidays roll around. Because within the pressure cooker of the holidays themselves, it's already too late. Once you're in that moment, it's even more likely that things are going to go off script, as it were.
Right. And that might mean if they want to do it in person, obviously that first day when they get there or pretty mm-hmm. quickly thereafter, you'll get off on the right foot if you begin with that understanding. Well, and as a last note, just know you're not alone in this.
Oh,
many,
my God.
Many,
are you kidding me?
Many couples who have yeah. gone before have fought this same battle.
Yeah. Good luck and happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
You can count on me.
Let's face it, we still have a whole big territory of holiday problems and conflicts that we have not yet discussed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thrilled to say we're going to get some help on this next segment of the show to come from the amazing, fabulous, and wise advice columnist, Heather Havrileski. She writes the Ask Polly column for New York Magazine.
Yes.
Let's call her.
Let's do it.
Hello?
Hi.
Heather, this is Cheryl Strayed. I have Steve Allman here. How are you?
Hello. It's nice to hear your voices. I'm so excited to talk to you guys.
So listen, we are talking today about the holidays. Probably I don't need to tell you that a lot of people get really kind of stressed out about the holidays. A lot of problems that are kind of, you know, on sort of neutral or mute for many months of the year, suddenly the volume gets turned way up, especially over the winter holidays, Hanukkah and Christmas and Thanksgiving, when we have all of these family gatherings and expectations and so forth. Are you, as an advice columnist, do you get letters from people talking specifically about holiday challenges?
Well, last year I got a great letter that was just, how do I get through it? Mm-hmm. You know, how do I go home and be in the same house with my family for a full week without losing my mind, which is really my specialty because I live in Los Angeles and I fly home to see my family at least twice a year. Yeah, I usually use frequent flyer miles, and I usually stay for way too long.
Mm.
That's my thing. I like to challenge myself to stay for far too long and drive everyone crazy for far too long. I never stay in a hotel. I always stay in my mom's house, and my kids are there, and my husband's there, and we all sleep in the same bedroom. I mean, my mom's house is very small. So I'm an expert. I consider myself, this is a real area of expertise for me.
It's interesting, like everybody has these original problems, these very specific families, and yet it's such a common scenario. I'm curious what advice you gave, what advice you give yourself and what advice you give to other people when they say, how do I survive that week at home?
Well, my personal strategy, which arose about, I'm going to say 2 years ago, I noticed that I would go home And I would expect, you know what, I've done so much growing, and I've been in therapy for so long, and I really feel like I'm finally ready to just go back home, and everything's going to go smoothly because I am a fully realized person now, and I'll handle everything without any stress at all, and I'll make everyone magically handle each other with no stress at all. And I came to find that every single time I went home, about halfway through the week, no matter how well things were going, it would be a low point where I would go retreat to my childhood bedroom and I would say to my husband, they just want me to eat shit. They're just feeding me big platters of shit. Every time I turn around, there's more shit for me to eat. I can't handle them anymore. So prepare to eat big platters of shit is actually my mantra for going home. Not because my family beats up on me that much necessarily, but because that's how I experience it when they don't understand me, when the family dynamic is off. I mean, this is just how it comes at me. This is how I feel. So that used to be my mantra, but now actually I find something that is much more effective is understanding that everyone eats big platters of shit when they're around their own family, because all families, most families are at least mildly dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. I mean, however you define dysfunctional, you know, unless you grew up in a group therapy session that never ended, right?
Mm-hmm.
You grew up in a family that some people were not getting their needs met. They had no way of communicating those things. And half the time, you grow up and you still don't know how to communicate it. And I didn't realize that I kept going into these family situations with this expectation that I was going to lead us all to nirvana together by, you know, just let's all just say what we feel, you know? And my family is not interested in that. I am the feeler that, you know, whatever, we all feel things. We're all sensitive, but I'm the one who talks about it. And I actually started to realize I was crowding everybody and trying to force it. So I think that letting it flow, right, just letting it be what it is and accepting it for what it is such a big part of getting through it.
Yeah. One of the biggest moments, essentially, of enlightenment in my own life had to do with that very word you just used, acceptance. And for me, it was essentially accepting that what's true is true. And listening to you, it's fascinating to me that in both cases, both those mantras you talked about, go in knowing you're going to eat a platter of shit, that led to the realization everyone's eating a platter of shit. And in both cases, what you've decided to do is surrender to the truth of the situation instead of constantly trying to battle against it.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be incredibly liberating. And what you're doing when you do that is you're letting go of expectation. You know, at the outset, you described going home, you know, and thinking, okay, I've gone through all this therapy. I'm going to go home and be a different person. And you go home and it ends up that you're a slightly different person in the same family. And what that brings out in you is all that old stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
The old person that you used to be in that family system. And so much of the holidays is about expectation,
mm-hmm.
wanting to be sitting around that dinner table, you know, sharing feelings and laughing and having great memories. And sometimes that happens and sometimes it doesn't.
And especially for the people who write in, the people who are sending us letters around the holidays or just in general, I think they can generally be people who are typed as fixers. That is, the people who want to fix the situation, who know that there are things out of balance and relationships that haven't quite healed and truths that haven't been spoken, and so they want to fix it. I am always in this role in my family, and it is always disastrous. The thing you have to do is stop trying to fix it and pretending that you're the person who's going to be able to fix it and just be present with the people who are there. This was my attitude with Thanksgiving. I went and visited and had a Thanksgiving with my in-laws, and rather than having a list of complaints in my head or breakthroughs that I wanted to make with this more emotionally reticent family, I was like, let's just have some pie. I will admit I got a little stoned. I ate way too much and just talked about whatever dumb fucking stuff we wanted to talk about. And it was actually incredibly unburdened to sort of lift the mantle of being a fixer from myself. So for our letter writers, keep that in mind. You're writing to us because you have a fantasy in the back of your mind, like Heather, that you're going to go home and Christmas or the holidays are going to be this occasion where you're going to fix things. That's the wrong agenda.
Yeah, I think that's great, and it's so true. And it is very much the kind of person who writes a letter in the first place to an advice columnist, because
right. There's
this feeling that, you know, I mean, if you feel empowered in your own life, and you feel like, you know, I've taken charge of all these things, I've changed all these things, and it seems like anything is possible, you know? If things are going well, you feel like anything is possible. When it comes to family, it just doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think that it, you know, that you can go in, I mean, I didn't even understand when I first started talking to my therapist about my family, why he, whenever I'd say, I can work it out, I'll just talk to my mom about it, he would get this look like, oh, no, I don't know. I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to work, you know. And the fact is, just as you said, Steve, when you sit around and you make space for people to just talk about the shit they want to talk about,
right,
and to be as shallow as they feel like being or as concrete as they feel like being, sometimes I think that I actually added stress to my family just by not being relaxed, mm-hmm, because I always had an agenda, you know?
Right.
When you have no agenda, you can actually set everybody else at ease in a way that they're able to be present, you know, that they weren't able to be present before because your agenda was kind of ruling, you know, it was adding tension to the room.
Yeah, they pick up on it immediately.
And can I just say that eating a lot of pie is a very valid agenda?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So maybe it's not to have an agenda, but to have one that will actually make you happy.
One year I had this Tetris game that was like a handheld game. It was like, you know, 15 years ago maybe. And my agenda was eat pie and play the Tetris game, no matter how angry it makes everyone else. I had a very relaxing vacation. I didn't take anything too personally. I mean, we all have our methods, right? Of
mm-hmm.
just like, you know what? I'm going to have to zone out a little bit. I can't always be present.
So we do want to read you a letter because we wanted to get your take on a very particular aspect. We've talked a lot about the heaviosity of family, but there's also this real fundamental thing with Christmas and Hanukkah where it's about gifts and it's about a material exchange that happens that's supposed to stand in for a kind of emotional transaction as well. So will you help us sort through this letter?
Sure. Sounds great.
So here it is. Dear Sugars, I have a problem that may seem small to many people, but it feels big to me. I have a wonderful boyfriend, and we are so in love. We've been together for more than 2 years, and we recently moved in together. I've never felt so close to anyone as I do to him. The problem is he rarely gives me gifts or cards. For every birthday, anniversary, or Christmas, I spent weeks finding the perfect gift. I often spend hours making him a card. I do not expect this level of gift-giving from him, as I deeply enjoy doing this for people that I love. But what I would like is some sort of card, even if it is store-bought, and a small gift that shows he cares would be nice as well. But I would be pleased with just the card. My reasoning is that these occasions present the perfect opportunity to show someone that you care about deeply, but see every day how much they mean to you. I've explained that I don't care how much money he spends and that something homemade means more to me than anything. Sugars, he loves to do art and draws or doodles all the time, which makes me sadden further when I don't get a card from him. He says he understands, and although it's not something that is important to him in general, that it is important to him because it's important to me. But I haven't seen much change in his behavior. He often offers me money or to buy me something that I want for a specific day, but I have told him that I really just want him to pick something out for me himself. It seems to me like gift-giving is an afterthought for him. It's hard for me to imagine spending my life with someone who does not exchange a little something to mark our years together with me, and I so deeply treasure the cards and gifts he's given me. Does this make me a selfish or materialistic person? Is this something that I just need to accept about him? Please help. I really want to spend my life happily with this man, and I'm sure if I can figure out how to proceed with this issue, we can sort it out. I'm willing to compromise, but not sure what that looks like or how to move forward in that direction. I don't want to sell myself short like I have done in so many of my past relationships. Signed, materialistic?
Well, I can just say that I felt this letter in my own heart. I have many times been in this situation. I was going to say especially with a romantic partner, but now that I think about it, exclusively with romantic partners. I remember one memorable Christmas. I had this high school boyfriend, and obviously we were teenagers, but we were really in a serious relationship and had been dating each other a couple of years. And I remember saving money to buy him this like incredibly cool and pricey, at least for me back in those days, boombox. And I gave it to him, and he said thank you. And I got that kind of lump in my throat because it became clear to me that he didn't have anything for me, which I don't understand. It was Christmas. I was his girlfriend, his longtime girlfriend. And so we drove. We were parked in one spot, making out and so forth, and I gave him his present. And then we drove onward, and he stopped at this gas station that actually his parents own in the town where I grew up.
Sexy.
And he said, hold on, I'll be right back. I have to go inside. Okay, so then this is so horrible. I'm waiting in the car, trying not to cry, and I'm thinking, surely he's maybe hidden in the gas station, you know, the nice, beautiful box of whatever he's wrapped up for me.
Oh, yeah.
But no, he comes walking out of the gas station carrying a 12-pack of Diet Coke.
Oh.
And he hands it to me, and he says, Merry Christmas. And I look at him, and I'm really, really trying not to burst into tears.
Oh, my God.
And he
God.
Says, what? You love Diet Coke. So anyway, it was a horrible gift. And what it was is a gift that almost, it just announces the fact that he didn't do what materialistic's partner has also not done over
right.
time, is to really consider the occasion. Mm. But, you know, I have to say, I've evolved on my thinking on this. I understand why I was disappointed. I also understand that clearly, you know, this guy loved me, and gift giving was an afterthought for him. It mm-hmm. wasn't something that was important to him as a sign of our bond.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that is interesting, because I probably would have brought you a can of gas, frankly, that would, and I would have thought it was rather gallant of me. You know, she says a small gift that shows he cares. So this is the idea, and this is where Aaron and I sometimes get into trouble, that there's really an emotional transaction that's wrapped within that material transaction. And, you know, that's the way she sees it, and they've talked about it, and he's agreed that it's important to him because it's important to her, and then he hasn't followed through on that. And that
right.
makes him, to me, a bad actor in this scenario. But I will also say that I have been that bad actor in the sense that gift giving for me is not what it's about. The way that I show love and concern is in a different set of ways. And now I'm much more careful about it because I know it's important to Aaron, and that gifts signify more for her. But I still probably fail in that department. And it's really, in a certain way, almost nothing personal. More alarming to me is the idea that this little microcosm is the reflection of a larger pattern in her relationships. As she says at the end of this letter, kind of ominously, I don't want to sell myself short like I have done in so many past relationships. That's where I would turn your attention. Is this little situation where you have a guy who you're, you know, adore, but you've told him explicitly that this is important and he's not able to heed that, is that symptomatic of a larger sense of his not really hearing your emotional and psychological concerns, which would be bad news, Christmas or otherwise?
You know, I think that that's really what the letter is about. Because personally, my husband and I are both pretty terrible about getting gifts at all. And as we've let each other off the hook, we get even worse at getting gifts, to the point where he said the other day, do you want anything for Christmas? And I said, I don't know. Let me think about it. I'm not sure. But because I feel so secure in the relationship and we talk about everything all the time and we're both happy in the relationship, it's hard to imagine changing my attitude based on a lack of a gift or a gift, either thing. And then, Cheryl, I kind of have a story that's a little bit worse than yours.
Oh, no.
Awesome.
Tell it.
I was 34 years old. I had been living with my boyfriend for 2 years. And the day of my birthday, I was turning 34. He ran out the morning of my birthday and came back with a DVD of Finding Nemo that he that he didn't wrap. And keep in
well,
mind,
it was wrapped in plastic,
together.
Heather. Be fair. It was wrapped
it
in plastic.
It was wrapped in plastic. That is fair. That
and
is
you're
fair,
living together, so it's a
was.
Present for him, too, Finding Nemo.
It's
he
a present for him,
watch.
Yes. So, but then that was bad enough. I was disappointed. Then he went on vacation back east, and he told all of his friends that I was mad at him because what I really wanted for my birthday was an engagement ring.
Wow.
Okay, which he reported to me when he came back from his trip. I said, how did everything go? And he said, everyone was wondering why you didn't come. And I said, well, what did you say? And he said, well, I told them you really wanted an engagement ring for your birthday and you were really disappointed. And I said, you know, I would have taken an engagement ring, but the real issue is that I got Finding Nemo.
Yeah.
But also, what I'm trying to say with that anecdote is that the issue is the level of commitment and the level of care that the other person is showing.
Correct.
My husband shows care towards me all the time, and this boyfriend was letting me know that there was no way he could do anything but run to the drugstore. And so with this letter, I feel like the big question is, why do these gifts matter so much? I mean, it is one thing to be someone who believes in gifts and believes in gestures, but look, if you say to someone, if you've said to someone repeatedly, gifts and gestures mean the world to me. I don't care if you spend a cent. I just want you to make a gesture. I mean, maybe she needs to sit down with him one more time and say, I need this. I don't care if you think it's stupid.
Right.
I'm telling you right now that I really need this. You know, it's hard when you're in a relationship to actually sit down, especially if the commitment is uncertain. It's very difficult to sit down and say, this is what I need from you. Let me be explicit.
Right.
This is what I want you to do. I mean, I've been in relationships where I've said to my boyfriend, you know, I'm going to spell it out for you.
Right.
Because you don't seem to be getting it.
Yeah.
And actually, it works.
It does.
If the person cares, it works. There's a worry in the back of my mind with this whole letter that I wonder if she is open to information that she's taking in that says he is not caring for her. I wonder if she can only see it with the gifts, but she can't see other ways in which he neglects what she specifically asks for. I mean, that's what I'm paranoid about, you know, after reading that.
Yeah, to refine that materialistic, is it that you are sort of locating within fixing the gift-giving system in your relationship, having him, you know, make you a card and give you a gesture in that way? Is that taking the place of a more fundamental anxiety that you have that this guy is going to be yet another in a series of men or women, partners, for whom you have sold yourself short? I, too, had that sense, that suspicion, that anxiety that maybe she's saying, if I can just get him to give me the card, I'll round up to him really caring for me in the essential ways I need.
Mm-hmm. I think we've offered a lot of thoughts about, you know, the sort of emotional underpinnings of these feelings and things that she can do in her relationship when it comes to, you know, talking and thinking and reflecting and communicating. But I will say, I also just have a little bit of practical advice for materialistic. And it's been a great way forward for me in my own marriage to say, let's sort of just get rid of all this feeling of like expectation and doubt and hurt feelings and all that stuff around gift giving. A long time ago, when I was realizing, you know, every Christmas and anniversary and birthday, I was feeling like, oh, am I going to feel loved by, you know, what my husband decides to get for me? We just decided that we would get rid of that kind of exchange. And by it not for every occasion, but for most, like our wedding anniversaries and Christmas, actually buy things that we chose together for us. So for example, every wedding anniversary, we find a piece of art that we love and purchase it for our house. And likewise at Christmas, it's like, let's figure out something fun we want to do with each other and give it to each other. And it can be something as simple as saying, okay, our budget is $300 and we're going to hire a babysitter and spend the afternoon in our favorite independent bookstore, spending that $300 on whatever books we want. It's that kind of thing where it becomes then not about what he gave you and what you gave him, but what you gave each other and what you get to enjoy together.
Yeah. And it also, you found a new kind of like ritual that is now part of the tradition of your marriage that feels, you know, there's less pressure, built-in pressure to it. You know, sometimes the best person in the world is just flattened by the pressure to find the right gift, especially
Absolutely.
If they've failed a few times at getting a good gift.
Yeah.
I mean, my husband's done that.
And the question is always in the giver's mind as a bad gift giver, is this a gift or is it a test? You know, which is it? Again, sometimes people just aren't being attendant and that's symptomatic of something deeper. But there is also this sense that you're bringing into this materialistic, I spend weeks finding the perfect gift. Okay, well, you're proving something to yourself about your own empathy and concern, but you cannot inflict that on a partner for whom he doesn't have that same way of showing you consideration. The question is, does that same concern and empathy and attention manifest itself in other places in your relationship?
All right. So I hope we offered you some, useful advice materialistic. We right. don't think you're materialistic. We think you're human.
Yeah,
right. We've all had those feelings.
You know, the boyfriend is just listening to this whole thing and being like, all right, so I got to get her, I think it's a Nemo and a 12-pack of Diet Coke.
I'm
out of the woods.
Oh, she will love it.
That's
Send
right.
Send her a clear signal of what's going on here.
So, Heather, we loved talking to you, and thank you so much for offering your insight. You know, you're kind of good at this advice-giving thing, I have to say.
I'm going to try to go out and apply these skills. No, I had so much fun talking to you guys, and I obviously I'm a huge fan. Have a great holiday and a good new year.
You have a great holiday, too.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Bye.
So the next letter we have is a lot more, I think, full of sorrow.
Yeah, it's a bruiser. Let me just read it. Hello, Sugars. My grandfather is a child molester. After I came out about the molestations 20 years ago, my family fell apart. My dad went insane with rage and caused an enormous amount of emotional damage for me and everyone else. The rest of my family protected my grandfather, so the result was that I felt like a black sheep growing up. My relationship with my grandmother is complicated. We've kept in touch, but I rarely see her since I refuse to be around her husband and she has refused to leave him. No one else bothered to reach out to me over the years. At 18, I moved as far away as I could possibly get. A few years ago, my cousin found me, and we've since become very close. She divulged to me that she had a similar experience with her grandfather that she keeps secret, or, in her words, doesn't bother with. 2 years ago, my dad died suddenly of a heart attack. I was 9 months pregnant, couldn't fly, and therefore missed his funeral, along with the opportunity to see my family again. At the time, I was honestly relieved not to have to go. Once I was able to visit his grave with my new baby, I called my grandmother to see if she'd want to visit, maybe go out for lunch. She said I'd have to come to her house, but since I didn't want to see her husband, I didn't go. I was, however, able to reunite with my other cousins, their kids, and my brother, which felt good, like maybe forgiveness was possible. Now my entire family is inviting me to come home for Christmas. I still feel the rage, though I can't tell if it's mine or my father's, and also the enormous guilt that if I allowed myself to be part of the family again, I'd be somehow disrespecting my dad, who was the only one to take my side, for better or worse. I'm also still hurt that no one except my cousin ever tried to know me in 20 years. If not for her eagerness to bring me back into the family, none of this would be happening. Part of me wants to finally introduce my son to my grandmother and spend Christmas with my brother, and part of me wants to hold out, wishing that son of a bitch would just die already. I want to be a forgiving person. I want to be at peace and put the anger away, but I also want to honor and protect myself and the memory of my father. Should I accept the invitation? Signed, Distant Sheep.
Wow, what a letter, huh?
Yeah.
I think there are so many questions. This letter culminates in one.
Yes.
Should I accept the invitation?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that that's the last question that we should get to
in
discussing this, because, of course, this is so much more complicated than a yes or no answer.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's so much we have to unpack. One of the first things I want to say to you, Distant Sheep, is that it's very common, this experience that you're having, where you have been sexually abused by a family member and then other members of the family don't either believe you or, probably worse, they believe you but they don't really care and they don't side with you or in any way censure the molester, but rather essentially ostracize the victim survivor. And I'm so sorry that that's what happened to you.
Yeah.
One of the first questions I have, though, as I read this letter, Steve, is why does Distant Sheep want to go back to this family who didn't reach out to her or love her or in any way be present for her in her life, aside from this cousin who's now making a relationship? I think that that's a really important question for Distant Sheep to ask herself. She says it's important to her that she introduces her son to her grandmother and that she spends Christmas with her brother.
Yeah.
And I understand, my heart understands that. I feel that what that kind of statement rises out of is that hurt child within.
Yeah.
That experience she had long ago that she hasn't yet healed. But my head says, these are people who have rejected her in every way.
You know, there are two things that she's had to suffer. And the first was, you know, what her grandfather did. And then the second and more, complicated and disabling part of it is that her family didn't take up for her. Instead of there being a reckoning, there was dad going over the top and everybody else turning away and saying, let's not deal with this. Obviously, the question of making amends with his grandfather is not on the table. The question is, what about the rest of the family? And I can understand why, especially around the holidays, especially with this invitation which she received, the tentative but important step she's taken to trying to make some connection with this cousin. I understand completely, distant sheep, why now you feel like, oh, I have this opportunity. The problem is that, and this is the part that really confuses me, it would be happening, it sounds like, in a way that wouldn't be on your terms. And even when she came back and, you know, called her grandmother, she's got a little baby. She's come home to bury her father. And the grandmother's response isn't, yes, of course, I want to see that baby. And maybe we'll just ignore the big, ugly thing that's also in the room so that we can focus on the little beautiful thing that's in the room. Mm-hmm. It's, sure, if you want to come to my house. What?
Right.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Even if you live in a world in which your husband didn't do these things and they're just accusations, it's still crazy to say, yes, you have to come to my house in order to interact with me. And ultimately, it's this kind of battle of who's going to be in control.
Yeah, that's my thought, too. I do think that there's a world of difference between time passing and those family members who had done the wrong thing back in the day, those 20 years ago, when those family members didn't stand with distant sheep, coming to her and saying, look, we were wrong, and we didn't know how to react, and so we did the wrong thing. We did the safe thing, which is to try to make this fact go away.
Right.
And please forgive us, and we welcome you back into the fold, and we will do everything we can do to protect you.
Right.
Even if they fall short of rejecting the grandfather. Now, they're not doing that. They're saying, sure, come on back. But everything in Distant Sheep's letter tells me that they're saying, come on back, but
and
remember that you're
shut.
Going to follow
right.
our rules. Even the cousin who says, you know, I was also abused by this same man. And so my grandfather also molested me too, Distant Sheep. I don't know if you're a regular listener of this podcast, but I've talked about that. And I have a different dynamic because my mother and father divorced shortly after I experienced the sexual abuse. And then I never saw my father's family again. So I didn't have to deal with this particular dilemma that you're dealing with. But I understand the emotional reality that you're in right now. And I think for me, a huge part of my journey in healing from that abuse had to do with realizing so much of forgiving and healing that hurt had to do with me getting right with myself,
right.
Not needing that grandfather to come back and say sorry, not needing my father, who years later became aware that I had suffered this abuse, saying, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't protect you. You know, having to sort of detach myself, I guess, from any expectation
right.
that anyone around me would make it better.
Right.
And Distant Sheep, I have to say, I feel like that you're in some ways looking to your family, these other people who did abandon you. You're looking to them to heal this wound that only you yourself can heal.
Yeah.
And part of what I'm really afraid of for you is that I can see, it's like a train coming really fast toward us, that I can see that the situation you describe here doesn't look like it's going to be a healing experience. Mm-hmm. It looks like you're going to go home for Christmas and be profoundly disappointed and maybe re-traumatized.
Yeah. In fact, one of the things that's so kind of baffling is the implication is that the grandfather would still be there. And in other words, that part of at least the family's agenda is to get her in the same room with the grandfather. And by some strange calculus in their hearts, that would make her accusations
yeah.
go away and the reality that stands behind those accusations. And that's completely nutso.
Yeah.
Right? So just so you are clear on that, that's nuts.
I also want to say, as a side note, something that you mentioned a couple times in your letter, this idea of honoring your father's memory mm-hmm. by staying angry and by not reconnecting. And I just want to say that's a useless notion. Your father is dead.
Right.
There is no honor to protect. The greatest thing you can do to honor your father is to thrive.
Yeah.
And to be that person who he loved so dearly. Mm-hmm. And that gets to be all kinds of things. It's not about, you know, protecting some sort of rage that he had that you were victimized in this way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that for your own life, holding on to that rage would be nothing but destructive.
Right. It's an essential point to make because the letter is filled with this basic conflicting impulse. The first is to forgive.
Uh-huh.
And the second is, I want that son of a bitch to die already.
Right.
Right. Understandably. You're writing, my dad went insane with rage and caused an enormous amount of emotional damage for me and everyone else. So don't continue that tradition. What's wonderful to hear, actually, in the face of this, is that this woman has not given up on the possibility of forgiveness. And it's not just with her cousins and their kids, but also her brother. Like, she is still open to that possibility. And that is quite an amazing thing, actually. But if you're going to seek contact with those people on your own terms, you need to figure out within yourself how much it is important that some discussion or at least recognition of what came between you, the feelings of abandonment you had, the sense of betrayal, is important to bring up and with them so that you're not just walking into a situation where you're, you know, connecting on one level and deep within you is beating this sense of like, wait a second, we're not talking about the thing that's in the room.
Yeah.
Your grandmother, as beautiful as it might be, the possibility of her meeting your child and so forth, she might, of her own volition, because of her unwillingness to accept your truth and what happened to you, your life essentially, when it's inconvenient to her psychically, might be giving up that possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And along with it is you are robbed of the possibility of that relationship between your grandmother, who you love, and your child. That's a terrible thing, but it would be even worse to consent to her delusion, essentially.
Right. So should I accept this invitation, Distant Sheep asks? And I think we both say no.
Mm-mm.
And I think that speaks volumes, because you'll notice on this show that very seldom are we so clear. This feels like no to me, which is different from us saying, don't try to reconnect.
Right.
That there are all kinds of people that we can reconnect with across many, many, many mistakes and divides and flaws and even abuses, frankly.
Yeah.
And I think that this doesn't sound like a family that's ready to do that yet. And this goes out to all of the people who are having this question, should I go home for the holidays or not?
Mm-hmm.
We think of the holidays as this time of great family togetherness, and that this is the time to sort of set aside differences and come together to, you know, metaphorically and literally break bread. But I do think that there are times that you have to set that boundary and say no, because that family is destructive to you ultimately,
mm-hmm.
but especially at the holidays,
that
you say that you need to make a healthy choice for yourself. And so we send all of you, Distant Sheep and all the other sheep in the flock who have a similar dilemma. Sometimes it's okay to stay home with yourself and gather around you the family that you've made in your new life and feel the love of that warm fire.
Yeah.
Think about the way that things could be if people all over the world could just see them too.
So one of the things, Steve, I'm struck by as I reflect on this conversation that we had with each other and with Heather, you know, I love that image of Heather alone in her childhood bedroom. I think so many of our listeners can relate to that in either literal or metaphorical terms. And of course, people like Distant Sheep or people like me, we don't get to return to those childhood bedrooms in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these things can be incredibly full of turmoil and sorrow, but they can also be received as really gifts in our lives. I think that it can be incredibly illuminating to use this holiday season to reflect on the way that we get to make our life and remake those families of origin. And some of that remaking has to do with, as Heather said, just having a new idea about what it is you expect to receive. So I wish you all a beautiful holiday season.
I listen to the voices as they float my way. It must be the music that the angels play. If people all over the world could just hear it too. Man.